a local gallery here in Chinatown called Center A. The director invited me to organize a curated dinner commemorating that. And I went, okay, how come I don't know about this? And it happened just a few months after the incorporation of the city. Yeah, Chinese workers are brought in to clear the land in Coal Harbor area. And white workers got angry because, you know, they got paid more than the Chinese, which is why these land developers liked to use the Chinese because they could pay them less. You know, back then, they were organizers in their unions, right? But it was white exclusive with, as far as I know, only a couple exceptions. And they're really interesting exceptions, but that's another topic. So these hundreds of white men got steamboats to go to Coal Harbor, and they attacked the workers there, burnt their bedding, burnt their tents, and then went off to Chinatown to attack that. So, yeah, I created this curated dinner called the Unwelcome Dinner, and that was just the precursor of what got me into looking deeper into the 1907 riots.
Tell me about the tour and what led you to do that, and then maybe just a little bit about the tour itself.
Yeah, sure. So just before this project, the 360 video project, I had actually created a pop-up food event on the streets commemorating the 1907 riots in four locations along the parade and demonstration and then the riots. So it started off in Larwell Park, or what used to be called Canby Street Grounds. So I actually set up this makeshift table right outside, like between the the tank and the cannon, and offered food from five cultural perspectives to anybody walking by on the street to come and sit down and share what they knew about what happened on this very location in 1907. So the five foods were indigenous, because we're on their land. White, because they think we're on their land. Or they thought. Chinese, Japanese, and Punjabi. So the indigenous one was candied smoked salmon with pickled spruce tips. It was kind of high-end. The Chinese one was actually low-end. It was poor. What poor people would have been eating, which was congee, tying a little bit of ground pork, and very North American addition, some corn. I worked with the chef, Chris Barnholden, who's actually the son of Michael Barnholden, who I eventually would co-write the script with for 360 Riot Walk. The Japanese was mochi with a red bean paste inside. The Punjabi was dal with the chapati. And the white meal was nice. It was Sunday dinner. Do you know what that is?
So like roast beef with potatoes, maybe?
Yorkshire pudding.
Yorkshire pudding, sure.
Yeah. And horseradish.
Of course.
Yeah. So all the stuff was made fresh in the morning. The chef brought it out, and what needed to be reheated, we heated on a little propane stove. And it was sort of asking the question, what would you have eaten as an angry white man before you go out to attack the Chinese and the Japanese in their homes? And what would you have eaten just before they came to attack you in your homes? Or what would you have eaten watching the white men attack other Asians, but not you, because you just got attacked in Bellingham 3 days before? Or what would you have eaten watching the white men attack Asians on your land? So, yeah, I mean, it happened in the four different locations going into Chinatown, also Powell Street area, as well as in front of where City Hall used to be, which is right next to the Carnegie Center, Main and Hastings.
Right, and so from that, from the sort of food-focused installation, you then decided to do a video tour, or what? How does that come about?
Yeah, thanks for bringing me back on track.
Of course, that's my job.
Yeah, it's like he's not answering my question.
Oh.
So to kick off these 4 weekends of these pop-up food offerings, we started off with a walking tour by Michael Barnholden, who is a local poet and the author of Reading the Riot Act, A Brief History of Riots in Vancouver. So he'd been leading these 1907 riot tours for years, on and off, here and there. And it was during that walking tour that I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if I could just can this tour so it's available anytime? And it wouldn't be great if it was an interactive kind of tour where I could bring in imagery that would be related to the subject matter. And then I thought, oh, I think I just came up with my first ever 360 video idea, which I'd been waiting for years, because I've always wanted to work with the technology. And that's how it came about.
Tell me about the experience itself. What will people experience if they do this tour?
So for anybody who has access to the internet and has a computer or a phone and a browser, like, you know, Chrome, Safari, Edge, Opera, whatever, you type in 360riotwalk.ca and it'll take you to a website, and just somewhere along the line you can click on launch the tour. It'll take you to, well, the splash page of that thing. You get to choose a language: English, Cantonese, Punjabi, or Japanese. And it has the Squamish language embedded in each of the first stops of all of them. I tried to get Squamish, but the translators were just too busy. It's hard to get a translator.
Yeah,
they're just kind of stretched thin, right? And then you just go to that location if you can, or if not, you just, you know, look at it on the internet, and you can make it rotate and zoom in and out and so forth. So here, like, for instance, we're at stop 7 in Shanghai Alley. You see this image on the screen. You take your finger, you drag the image around until it lines up to what's directly in front of you. Then you tap the little green button, and that activates your gyroscope, which means it'll start to move with your body. So if you look up, the imagery will follow you up. If you turn left or right, it'll do the same. You can use your fingers to zoom in and out. Press play, the audio track goes, and there you go.
And what sort of images and content is in there for people to see?
There's like 120 or something like that images in there over the 13 stops. There's all the archival old pictures we colorized, and then the imagery of current Vancouver turned into black and white. Kind of did a flip, right? And superimposed where we can, the same locations, buildings, landmarks, etc. Gassy Jack was still there as a statue. So that's in the tour. And the very last stop, Oppenheimer Park, it was a tent city back then, so that's in the tour. And then a few other details have changed since then. There's documents, like, for instance, the Royal Commission for Compensation that William Lyon Mackenzie King, well, it's just the front page of that one. But there's also drawings and illustrations from publications around that time, including from the U.S., that we set up almost like posters or billboards in the landscape, the urban landscape, giving you a sense of the kind of sentiments that was prevalent back then, the anti-Asian attitudes, the kind of like tolerance for violence against the Chinese. Yeah, it could be a bit shocking for some people who aren't aware of the kind of environment people had to survive in. And, you know, again, reasons for, you know, the ghettoization of these people and of certain peoples within certain geographies, but also those places became safe spaces for them because they could protect themselves there as well.
And what do you hope that people who do the tour, walk through, visit the website, what do you hope they take away from the experience?
Well, I hope they learn a little bit about this place that we get to call home. If you have the privilege and the honor to live here, and if you don't live here, not just learn about this place, but hopefully you'll reflect upon your relationship to wherever you are and what stake you have in it and what you might take for granted. And hopefully also consider that not everyone has the same privileges, that some people are much more vulnerable than others, and what can be done about it.
And the reason I'm talking to you about this now in particular is because the Eastside Arts Festival is coming up and the tour is being included in that. What does it mean to have the tour as part of this arts festival that is focused on Vancouver's East Side?
You know, I'm really happy that it's part of the Eastside Arts Festival. It's ironic, though, because this project is focused on what used to be the center of Vancouver, right? But now it's the downtown East Side, which is actually a really large area.
Yeah.
Includes, from the water all the way to, I think it's 16th Avenue, maybe? Does it go all the way to, where does it go to?
Well, I mean, some Nanaimo? People would say, out to Commercial at least, maybe Nanaimo. Down into downtown.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly. It's in my book. This whole project turned into a book, White Riot. There's a picture of it in there, and I forgot. I'm sorry. Not an urban planner, obviously. And it's not like we have a sign saying, you are now leaving the downtown east side. Mm-hmm. And it might change in the future as well, what the designation is. So, I think it's... the East Side Arts Festival. Well, you know, East Side versus West Side. I mean, that brings up a lot of real estate questions, right? Class and privilege questions, which is actually connected to, I'm going to segue here, connected to the strategy of Marathon Realty, CP Rail, because they got a huge piece of land on the west side and they wanted to make sure the west side was always going to be better than the east, right? So that kind of differentiation, that which would always keep the land values higher, which would keep their investments more profitable, et cetera, et cetera. So I think, you know, all that kind of awareness, there again, there's legacies to today. Although the creep of effectively the west side keeps moving east as Vancouver keeps growing. So, does Eastside Arts Festival have panels about this? It'd be great, huh?
Yeah. We'll find out.
Yeah. Again, I didn't really answer your question.
No, that's interesting. Like, I think, first of all, the comment about, you know, it's interesting that it's the Eastside Arts Festival when this used to be the center of Vancouver, that it says a lot about the sort of cultural geography of this place, and as you're saying, the sort of like exclusion of certain peoples from parts of the city, and the ghettoization and all of that, right?
Yeah, marginalization. Because,
mm-hmm. Like a real physical, geographical marginalization, right?
Yeah, that strip between Main and Hastings, along Hastings, for about 3 or 4 blocks west. That was the core of Vancouver. That's where the nice businesses were. That's where Woodward set up, right? The expensive stores where you would go and get a nice suit or dress or something. The best tailor in Vancouver was at Columbia and Hastings, run by a Chinese guy. So he had white clients. He was so good.
Yeah, well, and then it seems less and less possible that it's coincidental that, you know, the sort of core of the homelessness crisis in the area is right adjacent to Chinatown and is right adjacent to all these areas that historically were sort of non-white areas. Right?
Yeah. Well, that's the effect of, I guess, the influential part of town moving away. And I guess that was more the 70s, you know, with the building of Pacific Center Mall and then the building of all the towers around, I guess, Burrard Street. So, yeah, the move west left something in its wake, and that never really got filled. Same way that the Powell Street area, you know, with the forced, when the incarceration of the Japanese Canadians, that left a lot in its wake and never really recovered as a fulsome a neighborhood as it was before. So, yeah.
All right, well, is there anything else you think people should know about your tour, your book, yourself?
Yeah, go buy the book. Mm-hmm. Yeah, White Riot. It's hopefully at your local bookstore, and if not, get them to bring it in. There are 7 contributors in the book, all of whom bring different perspectives and contexts in, ranging from labor activists to a piece about Chinatown and gentrification to why we shouldn't use the word Japantown, but either Powell Street or Paurugai, because the Japanese people living there never called it Japantown. So they want others to call it what they called it. And they're also not saying that other places in North America should not call their Japantown Japantowns. It's just that specific to here. As a Chinese person, we call Chinatown Chinatown, but Actually, in Chinese, it's Tong Yan Gai, which is Tang Dynasty people's street. So, because the Cantonese identify with the Tang Dynasty, but in English, this kind of go, yeah, Chinatown, whatever. As opposed to myself making a fuss about how my name should be pronounced, because there's the romanization, T-S-A-N-G, but that's not how you say it. I mean, it's not English, so it's Zheng. And yeah, I'm not going to say my own name wrong.
Great. Well, thanks a lot.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you again to Henry Zheng for chatting with me about 360 Riot Walk and the 1907 anti-Asian riots in Vancouver, and his book White Riot, which is out on Arsenal Pulp Press. You can find it by searching White Riot Henry Zheng, T-S-A-N-G, as he just said there. You can also find the Riot Walk on your own terms at 360riotwalk.ca, then the numbers 360riotwalk.ca. Or you can go to eastsideartsfest.ca and sign up for an in-person guided tour with Henry on July 19th or 20th as part of the Eastside Arts Festival, which runs from July 18th to 27th at venues all across Vancouver's Eastside Arts District. Once again, eastsideartsfest.ca for more info about that. And yeah, I definitely recommend that you check out 360riotwalk.ca. And if you have the time on next weekend, on the 19th or 20th, Saturday, Sunday next week, that you sign up and go do the walk with Henry, because I had a great time talking to him. I learned a lot, even though I have learned a little bit about the 1907 anti-Asian riots in Vancouver through some work we do here at the station and my own sort of independent learning and research. But he gave me a much deeper and more broader understanding of what happened and the sort of long-term results that led to sort of to the start of the war on drugs here, the Anti-Opium Act, and all sorts of stuff. Very interesting. And also Henry was just so generous with his time and just a real great storyteller. So I heartily recommend you check out the tour, and if you can, meet up with Henry on the 19th and 20th of July. Once again, eastsideartsfest.ca. Okay, I said at the beginning of the show that the theme was live music. We're running out of time for me to make that true, so we're going to hear from a new compilation from Light Organ Records, which is sort of the indie branch of 604 Records, the Nickelback and then sort of Jonathan Simkin affiliated record label that is doing a lot of great stuff for local music here in Vancouver. They have a new record called Live at Summerlight Volume 1, which releases August 4th. Half the tracks are out now on Bandcamp, and you can listen to them, and we're going to hear from CJSF alumna Hallelujah Hailu. This is a live version of Walmart.
The song's called Walmart. Walking through the grocery store, all sad and desperate and alone, hoping the cashier will stop and talk to me. It's funny having lots of friends, they don't notice when you don't talk to them. Get worried, cause when you're stressed, you think I'll buy a bag of grapes. I need more fruits and veggies anyway. It doesn't matter, I'll still die because I love smoking weed. They smile when they run.
Walmart by Hallelujah Hailu, Live at Summerlight from Live at Summerlight Volume 1 by Light Organ Records, which is out August 4th. And now this report from Lauren McKenzie at CHLY in Nanaimo.
This is a CHLY news update. Buttertup's Marsh Park is a bird watcher's paradise, but the marsh is also home to another animal that, while not always seen, is at risk of being endangered. The Western Painted Turtle is a slow-moving freshwater turtle native to Nanaimo and the rest of Western North America. The painted turtle is known for its red and yellow stripes on the head and neck and the red and yellow painterly pattern on its lower shell. While the turtle may live for 20 to 30 years, in British Columbia, the species is at risk. Painted turtles have called Buttertub's Marsh home for many years, and the Nanaimo Area Land Trust, or NALT, has been working to make sure the turtles continue to call the marsh their home with growing populations. CHY met at the marsh with Linda Broymans, stewardship manager for NALT, to talk about their conservation work. NALT has been surveying the turtles and its nesting habitats for 3 years. The Western Painted Turtle Project first started after Broymans was first contacted by the provincial government in 2006 to identify all habitats and areas where the turtles were located on the island.
But that their program was sort of starting to wrap up, and I was asking, is there anything that you think that a community organization can do, you know, something that's not, doesn't require too much training, but that regular folk can get involved in, because I know that people care about the turtles. So we started doing visual surveys at all other areas where people had reported seeing turtles. And from there, we were getting reports from the public, in particular about nesting turtles at Buttertubs.
When they started surveying the turtles in the marsh, they observed turtles basking. Basking is when they sit or float in a sunny spot and absorb the sun's heat through their bodies.
Gotten a lot of data on the turtles basking, where they like to bask and when and how many there are, roughly. There might be some hiding in nooks and crannies that we don't know about. But we've only seen one juvenile, and so that made us a little bit concerned about how successfully the turtles that nest here are able to produce young through to that, to the adult stage.
In the 3 years NALT has surveyed the turtles, they have only discovered one juvenile turtle. A turtle reaches its juvenile stage around its fifth year. Broyman says they have found that many of the turtles are not reaching their juvenile stage of life because of predators. Predators can get into the nest before the eggs can develop or can eat the hatchlings. Both local raccoons on land and invasive American bullfrogs in the marsh are the turtles' biggest predators.
And we discovered just by watching the turtles nesting, recording that information, that predators were getting to the nests within hours of the nest being laid. So that's why we've started to put the cages. And this is our third year where we're putting these cages. And if you look over here, you can see it's taken us some practice to find the best method, because the turtles will lay the eggs between mid-May to late July. And then the eggs take about 2.5 months to develop and hatch. And we found here that the hatchlings will actually stay in the nest through to the spring. So they hatch and then they go into hibernation right away, essentially. It's kind of crazy to think about.
Once a turtle hatches their eggs, a NALT volunteer, or turtle ambassador as they're called, will place the square cage with lining on top of the buried nest. Volunteers will continue to monitor the nest throughout the year. Currently, there are several nests along the Buttertub's Marsh Trail, with cages covering the area to keep both animals and humans away from disturbing the eggs. Nesting turtles need a dry, sunny spot located close to the lake to bury their eggs 15 centimeters underground. For the turtles in Buttertubs, that means many will make their nests in the middle of the trail that goes around the marsh. It's estimated there are approximately about 5 to 8 female turtles capable of nesting in the marsh today. Currently, NALT is in the middle of collecting its data on how the turtle population is performing in the marsh. They hope that since they started using the cages 3 years ago, that will mean in about 2 years, more juvenile turtles will start popping up, demonstrating that their work has led to more turtles reaching maturity.
Well, we're keeping tabs on where they're nesting and whether the clutches, you have the majority of the eggs hatch. And there was a nest farther down the trail where it seemed all the eggs, I think maybe 20 or so, hatched and made it out. But then you have others where you only have 2 out of 14 that hatched and made it out. Mm-hmm. So that means there's 12 eggs in there that didn't develop at all or partially developed, and then root material got into the egg and killed off the embryo.
As NALT continues to collect data on the turtle population in the marsh, they've also started working with Coastal Partners in Conservation. Coastal Partners in Conservation works in conservation efforts for the Western Painted Turtle, running a recovery program in the Lower Mainland.
They do have a head-starting program that they've done on the mainland, and where they will take eggs, incubate them, eggs that were laid in the wild by turtles at a particular site, incubate them, and then when they hatch, they'll keep them for about a year until they're a size that they're basically too big for most predators to eat.
While Broyman says they hope they don't need to run a similar program to help recover the population of the turtles in Nanaimo, NALT is now collecting data with Coastal Partners in Conservation to see if this is the best option.
But that a head starting program is really an intensive management strategy, that it's like you really have to feel like your population is in dire straits. And we just don't know enough about the buttertubs population to say that a program that intensive is warranted. But if it is, we're happy to know that on the mainland there is a program that would make that possible, because it would be awful to, you know, in 20 years there are no more Western Painted Turtle at Buttertubs. It would feel like a real loss, I think.
Broyman says about 3 years of surveying the turtles' nesting patterns and survival rates is needed. After they collect the sufficient data, the two organizations will work together to figure out how a head-starting program is necessary in Nanaimo. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
All right. Thanks to Lauren for that report, and to CHLY and the LJI for making it all possible. I'm Jesse. This has been Speak Up on CGSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. Democracy Now! Is up next. We're going to just listen to some empanadas ilegales. To take us to that, this is called Bailecito de Mold. See you next time.